All right, welcome everyone. I am recording, and the caveat is always, this is not therapy. This is not direct psychological advice. This is just me sharing experience and education around hypothetical cases or however you want to present things. Just prefer it not to be in the first person. Does anybody have any questions to start us off? If you don't, I can talk about things I'm working on. I think I've shared with some of you that I'm going to be doing a training for therapists in the Ukraine. I'm really excited about this.
Oh, I thought of one. I have one. Okay. It's about body dysmorphia and body image. How does body dysmorphia work? I know someone and he doesn't think he has it, but he's always like wanting to lose weight and stuff. So like, what happens in the brain when you see yourself as different, like fatter than you are?
So I usually like to start by pulling up official ideas before getting into my opinion. So I'm gonna look up body dysmorphia and then I'm gonna share my screen. So we can first look at some official words on that. Who should we go with? Mayo Clinic comes up first. I'll click on that one. There's something from Hopkins. And then there's, okay. So let me share my, well, okay. Yeah, just making sure I'm not revealing other things on my tabs. Okay, so you should be seeing my overall search. And this is part of why I do this is because to get through grad school, you have to memorize a lot, but I don't think there's a lot of wisdom in relying on memory when we can reacquaint ourselves with things. So that's why I turn to this stuff first. All right, so the Mayo Clinic, do people see this? Overview, I'm in a health condition in which you can't stop thinking about one or more perceived defects or flaws in your appearance, a flaw that appears minor or can't be seen by others. But you may feel so embarrassed, ashamed, and anxious that you may avoid many social situations. So the first thing they're pointing out is we're not talking about objective things where you got slashed in the face or you need reconstructive surgery after an accident. This is about something that's in the perception of the person. So you intensely focus on your appearance and body image. You're repeatedly checking the mirror, grooming, and seeking reassurance, sometimes for many hours a day. When things affect our normal life, that's sometimes part of the definition of what's normal and what's a dysfunction. So when we start seeing that many hours are spent, or that you're like with OCD, that you're washing your hands so many times that your skin is getting really chafed and raw, these are what help know, okay, that's reached a disordered level. Nothing wrong with checking your locks a couple times at night. But if you can't go to bed because you keep getting up to check them, now that's a disorder. Okay, you may seek out numerous cosmetic procedures. So places that offer these are really supposed to make sure that you are of sound mind rather than just, you know, it's funny because you can go to fast food and they, in theory, they do it your way. And healthcare is unfortunately becoming that way, where people are just going to give people what they want. But it really goes against deeper ethics, where you don't give a child a knife just because it insists. And you don't chop off someone's legs because they just see themselves as belonging in a wheelchair. Like, hopefully the profession will push back more than it seems to be pushing these days. So we are supposed to test because, I'm sorry, when I've done evaluations for like gastro surgeries, they want to make sure the person's going to be able to maintain the habits because there's a lot of risk involved. And if the person's going to go right back to eating really unhealthy foods and unhealthy quantities, then you're really not supposed to get a procedure done. Okay, so and interrupt me if people have questions or comments. So signs and symptoms, the extreme preoccupation with a perceived flaw that isn't objective, that others don't see or say is minor. Strong belief that
he's seeing extra fat that really isn't there to other people. He's like a mat, just hyper focused on it.
So I'm not going to diagnose him from a distance, but that is a suggestion that he's meeting at least one or two of these criteria. And then we go down the list. Let me pop over to these other ones if they say what the number is. So they say symptoms include, but I haven't gone to the DSM, which as a clinician would tell me, okay, you need five of these and three of that. And then this is just a questionnaire someone put online with these questions. You want to do this together? So Courtney, why don't you lead us through? How often do they deliberately check their features, not accidentally catch sight of it? Just approximate here.
Maybe 10.
You want to do between 10 and 20?
Yeah.
Okay. To what extent do they feel their features are currently ugly, attractive, or not right? So very ugly. How extreme do you want to go on this?
I think moderately.
On that one?
Yeah.
Okay. To what extent do their features currently cause them a lot of distress?
Oh, for him, extremely distressing.
Okay. How often does the feature currently lead them to avoid people, situations, activities?
Never avoid.
So they still live their life? They go out and about, do things?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he does.
Okay. To what extent?
I think he's just preoccupied with it in his mind. I don't know if it affects him.
Okay. And here's the, to what extent do they preoccupy them and hard to stop thinking about it?
I would say extremely.
Okay. If you have a partner, to what extent does the feature currently have an effect on a relationship with another person or dating and developing relationships?
Oh, maybe slightly.
This is someone that like already has a partner?
Yeah.
And you think it only slightly affects that person's relationship with that person?
Well, he doesn't really talk to me about his relationship, so I don't know.
But everything else you've described, I doubt the partner is just sitting there saying, whatever, that's fine.
Maybe.
So I'm going to kick that up to at least moderately. And then to what extent, and this is all hypothetical, so to what extent does this feature currently interfere with their ability to work or study or their role as a homemaker? In other words, how much getting up to check the mirror, how much research on the internet, how many minutes or hours are going into this?
Probably markedly.
Okay. So then, a couple more. To what extent do the features currently interfere with their social life?
Not at all.
I feel like we already kind of answered some of these, double dip a little. To what extent do you feel does that person feel their appearance is the most important aspect of who they are?
Mostly.
Okay. So this person got a 41 out of 72. If you scored 40 or more, we recommend you seek an assessment. You likely have it. Okay. So that's interesting. Even though we put some extreme ones, we only just barely made the cutoff. Between 30 and 40, you may still have it. Either way, though, again, like what you initially brought up, is somebody with these hangups could probably use some therapy. So, all right, constantly checking, avoiding mirrors. Well, this is a different, a person could either be looking at mirrors a lot in every car, every store window, or they're always on the run from it. But either way, neither is normal, or like there's some distress obviously involved. Trying to hide body parts, that are not normally hidden. So using hats, scarves, make, all right, constantly exercising, grooming, comparing, always asking whether you look okay, not believing other people when they say you look fine. Like that just rarely works. When people have these hangups, it just, reassurance is rarely effective. It's the same problem with OCD. When OCD, when you give into that and you wash your hands again or do whatever, the satisfaction lasts about 2 seconds. And then you're back to doing it. And so the treatment involves not giving yourself that, even those 2 seconds of benefit. You just have to kind of suck it up. And
what would be a good way to help the person when they're like, oh, I feel fat? Instead of just being like, no, you're not, because obviously that won't work.
I mean, I get very facetious and I say, well, if you are fat, I don't think you are, but if you're convinced you're fat, I guess you no longer have value as a human being. Like I'd start playing on what that would even mean and who cares.
Yeah, I'm going to try that on him.
You know, it's interesting. We've really only had, how long have we even had mirrors really available? A couple hundred years? Like I love how animals live. Animals don't look in mirrors. There's like only 3 or 4 animals that even understand that it's them in the mirror. So dolphins will realize it's them. And they've experimented with a lot of animals and only 3 or 4 can figure out that that's not a rival, that that's not some other dog, that that's not, like very few can realize that's them. Anyway, so human beings have this burden of not only living our lives, but watching the video recordings and the mirrors and wanting to know how we're doing. And it's exhausting. It's a really kind of sad aspect of our existence, in my opinion. So, okay, so you'll try the assurance, no, you look fine, and you experience that that goes nowhere.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to do what you said and be like, no, you are. And I bet that'll catch them off guard.
You could say, wow, yeah, you are probably like 70 pounds overweight. And by exaggerating, they will probably become slightly more objective and say, no, I don't think it's 70, but I do think I'm 5 pounds overweight. I don't know. It's probably closer to 70. You should probably, let's put up some pictures of Auschwitz and make sure you can, you're really comparing with skinny.
Yeah.
I don't think your standards are challenging enough. So I'm trying to rock their boat is what I'm doing there. Trying to question the whole thinking pattern, the who standards are right. Why is this so important to you? What would it mean to you if? That's a typical therapist question. What would it mean if? Would you have no value? What if you got a disease that just put weight on you? And what should we think of these other people? Should I start condemning? Should I be a fat shamer?
Fatphobic.
Yeah. Like let's start condemning people. Let's go on the internet and just say how awful these people are. And then they'll be like, no, you shouldn't do that. Why not? You're doing it. Why do you get a special pass? You're supposed to love your enemies. Start with yourself. I was reading something with Al-Anon or something where it was like, I was challenged to make a list of all the people I'd harmed, and I put myself at the top. That's a great insight. This is not just Courtney's, right? Jump in.
I have a question. Yeah. Actually kind of for Courtney, like, so was this person at one point, like, I'm just curious, was this person at one point a lot bigger or fatter or whatever than they are right now? Or what do you think, Dr. Fernando, like, what is that something that would, like, that they would continue to view themselves in this way, even though they're not that way anymore? Would that have an effect?
I've on seen things? That. Sorry.
He told me that he was a little chubby as a child and his brother used to make fun of him a lot.
That is the exact.
But he's not anymore.
that is the exact case I've seen in therapy, where it began in childhood. They were made fun of, and now they've taken over. Like, it's so ingrained that no amount of dieting will ever be enough, that kind of thing.
Right. Like, I have this friend that definitely was a little bit bigger, and she lost a lot of weight. And it was due to like a lot of trauma and a lot of stress. And she continued to see herself as that person that had all that extra weight for a really, really long time. Like, she couldn't see herself any other way, because it was just so, I guess, ingrained, right? It's just like, that's who you've been for so long. So that's what I was wondering, if that would have an effect on your mind, or like getting over it, if it's almost a trauma thing. Or like a, yeah, low self-esteem, like not accepting that you're not like that anymore, or feeling like, well, that's who I am.
Yeah, so I would be doing work around their thoughts and writing out, getting them into writing, what do you actually believe? And then starting to poke holes in that. And it's the same worksheets I use in trauma, where what's the evidence that you're fat? What's the evidence against it? Why is the 20th century, why is the 21st century the standard? I'd use some historical argument, but I'd really try to get them to realize they feel fat. It has nothing to do with being fat, that they're not dealing with thoughts, they're dealing with feelings. And that's harder to correct. But I would want to go over and correct the thoughts first, because if we don't correct those, then the feelings remain. It's like the interplay between fear. I feel scared, I'm in danger. Those are two separate things. You can be in absolutely no danger and still be terrified. And so we'd have to chip away at that, first acknowledge the difference, and then question, are we even dealing with reality, or just you have a standard that is unhealthy because you are not that thing? Like, oh, deep down, I feel like I'm 7 feet tall inside, and so I duck, and people say, why are you ducking? That doorway's 8 feet tall, you know? Oh, because inside I feel like a 7-footer.
So what if they don't feel that there's anything wrong with their mentality of how
I'm not going to force therapy on them. If they're not committing crimes, they get to go free. I don't, no skin off my back. We only intervene. Like, people get forced into things when they start stepping on other people's rights and freedoms. I don't know. I don't mean to be flippant. It's just like, it's being off is not illegal all the time. There are some ways that it's illegal. Or, I don't know, like New York City is dealing with it now. They're the movement in the 60s to get people out of psychiatry clinics, psychiatric wards. They thought all the hope with the new medications at the time. And so people were released. And then you have these homeless populations, and the most horrifying sight I've seen, and there were a lot in Hawaii, there were a lot in LA, a lot in New York, but the most horrifying I've seen is San Francisco. Anyway, so cities are starting to ask again, is it true that we're powerless? To what extent is this a little nutty that we're respecting the right to be on the street when you're just getting high and urinating all over the place? It's hard. There's going to be injustice one way or another. So I don't want to get too political, but I think we can say there are cases where we're not being unjust when we recognize someone's limitations to take care of themselves or to, I don't know, because right now there's a bias, obviously, to keep people from suicide. And society is not very consistent on freedoms. I have a hope people don't kill themselves, but I don't know about always turning to law for these things. I don't know. Anybody have opinions on that? I mean, it made me sad in Mississippi when I had a practicum a couple days a week at an inpatient crisis center where people would be brought for anything between 3 and 21 days. And most of them were being brought in sheriff's cars, sometimes in handcuffs. I mean, you have that overlap between, wait, is this mental health or is this law? Sometimes the person was dangerous, so needed to be restrained, but it was tough to see that and to see that you're adding trauma to things. You're adding, nobody wants to be thrown in the back of a squad car, but to an ambulance is better.
And I think the problem with that is that it would make, I imagine it would make a person fearful to actually speak out. If they don't know the repercussion, if they, you know, if they think that something bad will happen.
The system is really not great right now. I've had plenty of those clients that, you know, we had to leave the suicide question alone because they wanted treatment but didn't want to be locked up. And I happen to agree that you're going to do better living in your ordinary circumstance and learning to deal with stuff than taking these vacations into inpatient units that are apart from your normal life. Now, some people need it. There are cases where somebody's just being really unhinged for a few days and they do need a break. They need to not have to worry about cooking and cleaning and just sleep a lot and just be in that setting. And I've had a real frustration with the inpatient facilities where I've worked, where they don't treat the deep underlying stuff. They really see themselves as a Band-Aid, as an ER, and they send people home, even though there's a pattern where this person's life is too chaotic, they're not going to get the therapy they need. And that's where my passion for short interventions for trauma, that's where it started, is saying, goodness, I might have 3 days with this person or 3 hours. I'm going to do a lot. I'm not going to buy this thing about, oh, trauma takes 6 months and blah, blah, blah. It's nonsense. They can be doing a better job, but it's hard, right? Because people feel their jobs are threatened. Like, oh, if people don't need our facility, we're out of jobs.
And I think that some people just say that to vent. It's taken me a long time to really understand that.
No, like but that time. Would no, but if you tell a trained therapist, they don't just lock you up right away. They're like,
are no, you- but if you say okay, so my friend grew up hearing that, like, every day from her mother, and the mother never actually did anything, but it's like I think it clearly hurt the child, and that's irresponsible. But I think that, so then when the mother was asked, well, why do you still say these things? Well, I don't know, I'm just talking. Don't people just say that? Don't people just feel that way? Like, no,
right?
It's not normal. But to her, that was normal. To the frustration was just to such a point that she would say, I just want to kill myself.
Yeah, parents don't understand what these kind of things do to children, because parents think they're victims, that they're barely surviving, that they're weak, that they're not strong. So the idea of finding out later that the kid was terrified of them is news to them. So there's just a lot of ignorance like that. So that mother just sounds really ignorant, but I don't know that she would have sought the help.
Like, no, I don't know what happened or, you know, decades ago and what help there was and what shame there would have been in at the time or in certain cultures to not seek help. But I just don't think that would have been something that person would have even thought about doing.
Yeah. So in that case, that's just someone with very poor knowledge or education or imagination. Just not very concerned, not asking the questions about how am I raising my kids? What's beneficial? What's potentially harmful?
Yeah, like, and then talking about it now, you just sort of, I think there must have been enormous, not just frustration, but fear to say such things. You know, it's just hopelessness.
Right, so, right. And that I lash out at you. You people are all causing this. You kids are stressing me out.
Yeah, and that's not a reason to sort of like then.
No, and that's called wrong.
To lock someone away. Like that person needs some sympathy and some empathy, and rather than.
But parents shouldn't do what's called role reversal, where they expect the kids to be the parent,
right,
and to comfort them and to meet their emotional needs.
Right.
Those are all red flags where the parent should realize, oh, I need help. I shouldn't be doing this to my children. Happens a lot after divorce. Parents make the kids their confidant. They complain about the former spouse, or and the kid is just confused because early in life they can only think of who's good, who's bad. I don't know. Like, it's very confusing and doesn't need to be, and it's harmful. And you shouldn't pass your adult problems on to the kids. There is another question in the chat, so I'm going to turn to that in a few minutes, but I want to make sure we finished up like the body dysmorphia, the current topics on the table.
Oh, I'm fine. I'm good.
So the idea that you need to get into the feelings, help the person grieve that they're not, that they have some bug about what they're supposed to look like, and they're never going to measure up. And you might as well start grieving that now rather than live that desperate life of what if I do this? What if I do that? Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of self-rejection going on these days. I mean, there's just tons and tons and tons of, I don't like who I am. I want to be over there somewhere. This constant self-rejection.
What do you say to somebody who can't look in the mirror?
Why can't they look in the mirror? I don't buy that word. Refuse?
Just don't want to look at themselves.
Don't want to. So I'd clarify that language. Oh, why don't you want to look? I don't like what I see. You don't like yourself. No, just my appearance. I don't know. They come together. If we have a puppy that you won't look at, you're rejecting that dog.
Right.
In therapy, I use a photo of these really cute puppies and I say, okay, point out the ugly one. Like, oh, what if this one in the corner is having these thoughts? Like, oh, I'm not good enough. I suck. I'm not like the other dogs. And they say, oh, that would be terrible. Yeah, it is. It's really sad. You're fine the way you are. And you don't hang out with people who think otherwise.
Right.
Like, turn your gaze away from mirrors, away from these things. Live your life. Stop doing the bumper sticker of how am I driving? Like, how am I looking? Do good things. Get out of your own head. Go serve people. Go volunteer. Go live a productive life. Don't look for photo opportunities. Don't just forget all that side of it. There's so many people taking selfies during the most times that should be precious, that should be relational with the person they're with, not with the public on Facebook. So much dysfunction. Like, oh, here's my fiance proposing to me. Like, what the hell? That is so weird. I don't think half the population understands how weird that is.
Yeah, but then at the same time, people who don't do things like that, or and who decide they don't want to do social media and do Instagram and things like that, you're considered a weirdo. I remember when there was this whole research done a few years ago that said that people who don't have Facebook and other forms of social media, they actually said they have some kind of psychosis.
Oh, brother. And, come on. That's just stupid. Yeah.
So oh, I've become a weirdo as I've aged then, because I've totally stopped almost using
Facebook. I stopped years ago. Look, in fact, recently I tried to do a yoga certification, and they told me that I couldn't do it unless I actually was willing to have social media. And I said, I don't have social media. And they said, we can help you. We can help people like you. And I said, no, it's not that I don't know how to. It's just that I chose many years ago.
I don't want it. Right.
I just don't want it. And my life is much happier.
Good for
without
you.
Having to parade my plate.
So we do need to reduce things that we just don't need in the house. Like if alcohol is your problem, don't have alcohol in the house. I know people that get depressed when they look at Facebook. They can't be happy for other people when they see a new car. They're like, oh, why do they get to have that life? Then, yeah, get rid of it. Or for other reasons. You don't have to explain. You don't have to convince anyone else that if it's just not a good use of your time, treat it like any other subscription. Cancel it. Get rid of it. Okay. All right. So I'm going to read this other question. There's several things here. Oof. Okay. Oh, my goodness. I don't know if I could do all this. Hello, I have a hypothetical scenario I'd like to explore. So there's this guy that told me after age 11, he became depressed with a growing rage inside from never speaking up. So that's very normal, right? Kids suppress if the father beats them or something, and they just don't feel safe bringing stuff up. There's going to be rage inside. Then around ages 13 to 15, he mimicked some sexual acts on his kid brother on three occasions. One while the child brother was asleep, he used his brother's hand to touch. Okay, so some child abuse going on, which again is common when this stuff's inside and when we don't have healthy outlets or when we're exposed to things at an early confusing age. And we really don't even get concepts like harm, like this thing I'm about to do could really harm someone else. So it's kids hurting kids in this case. I'm not gonna read the details on that. Okay, more abuse. So then the kid stopped going near his little brother, realized that what he'd done was wrong, has had guilt for 10 years, punishes himself. It happened during like puberty, the first sexual feelings the person had. It's a discovery. He'll probably never forget. He's been trying to die because of this. But somewhere I read, but he denies he's still alive. So I don't believe that he's been that. I don't know. There's some mixed messaging. He holds anger. He clenches his teeth. There's rage. I mean, a lot of sexual acting out comes from rage, comes from frustration, revenge. It gets blurred and mixed together. Okay, the victim doesn't necessarily remember. That can be typical. Okay, more, I mean, it's common that if nothing interrupts it, more abuse happens on both ends. And like for the perpetrator and the victim, victims tend to get re-abused because their go-to response becomes to freeze. And when we survive something hard, the brain doesn't mess with success. So until we get a treatment, our tendency is going to be to freeze in any situation where we feel powerless, even though we're not 5 years old anymore. All right, this pedophile isn't that anything like the, I don't know, the hypothetical situation. He sought medically assisted death, but he's still alive. I think his 10 plus years of self-destruction is horse crap because he's alive. No, I mean, look, the guy is suffering. I don't deny the fact that he's still alive isn't proof of anything. He could be an alcoholic, a drug addict. He could be doing all sorts of, like he's probably suffering a great deal, which again is like, is jail really the right answer? Well, yeah, somebody was, there's a perpetration and all that, but historically, it's interesting. Sometimes people just get hanged right away. And in some ways, that's probably good for a society. I don't know. As opposed to these life sentences or waiting to be executed. I don't know. Anyway, so both parties need help. The victim, whether they remember it or not, you'd have to look at their life and how they're functioning, and is there stuff going on that would suggest there is undealt with trauma. If it doesn't bother them, then somehow their brain was able to like file it. And when we file things, like if we have a place for it, it can be put away. Like we're not all going to be haunted by unconscious memories and stuff. It's a case by case thing. The perpetrator needs help though. So this gets into what's called moral injury, where you violate your own moral codes. Or if they were so young, they didn't even have the codes figured out yet. But we all have a sense by age 7 or 8, we all kind of know when we're starting to lie or when something's not quite right or when something feels a little funny. So we may not define it as, oh, this is a moral disturbance I'm having. But we're starting to cross lines that we know we don't feel right about. And we wonder if someone, we wouldn't be okay if somebody saw us do it. Like these are indicators that, yeah, there's a conscience in there. There's something. It's not total ignorance compared to an animal or someone who truly lacks mental development. So my encouragement is to get that person into some therapy. Now, again, are they going to run into the problem where now there's some mandated reporting that goes on? And so I don't know. Maybe. It depends what state and how it's handled. It could go badly, in which case the person gets put on a criminal track. And that system's, I doubt that's ever going to help them. I think prisons, I don't know enough about it. I think some people probably get hardened and get traumatized in prison. Other people might get reformed. I don't know. So I don't know if I'm answering, I'm mainly saying the perpetrator needs help. They're not winning at life. They're suffering, and there's probably tons of effort to forget and to avoid the memories of what they did. And a lot of confusion, and they're probably not functioning well in relationships in the present. They're a danger to the future, to kids in the future, to whoever. There's just a lot of unresolved business there. And it's treatable. It's very treatable. I mean, so much of the same things apply. The feelings have to be identified and processed, the thoughts. This makes me a monster. No, maybe not. Maybe I was just in a lot of circumstances came together. You know, people have trouble understanding the Nazis and World War II. And it's like, it's actually not that complicated. A guy did, so maybe you're familiar with the Stanford prison experiment. A professor there in the late 60s was trying to understand the Nazi thing. And he did an experiment where he recruited students to play roles, and they coin toss decided who was a guard and who was a prisoner. And within the first day, the guards were already being abusive. The power, even though they were role-playing. And within a day, the victims, the inmates were already being passive and allowing themselves to be abused and being, it got really weird really fast, and they had to end the thing much earlier than expected. It's definitely within the first week. I'm not remembering if it was within by the fifth day or something. It just got really sadistic and bizarre. And that's, only a stupid scientist would say, well, it looks like we got some really bad apples there. It's systemic. It has to do with the roles you're put in, the culture, with who's saying what's normal. And so the idea that you're going to blame every Nazi youth, it's dumb. And I get very controversial because people, I once made a film 22 years ago in film school where I just compared a lot of issues in history where it's like, are we really going to blame every kid that became a Nazi? Are we really going to blame every person that was involved in the slave thing, are we really going to blame every woman that's done whatever? Like, just all these things to try to open consciousness to say the context is super important. And so the idea of criminalizing things is just, it always reduces it down to the individual. And then when that happens, new injustices replace the other one. Like, things get overcorrected. And then you end up with really weird politicians getting into office, because now you've created this injustice and this anger in another population. And then you get a Hitler, or you get other people that do really terrible things. Anyway, these are my opinions. Any thoughts?
Okay, I have a question. So as far as like, in regards to this kind of a situation, the person who was being abused and totally forgot, like doesn't have any recollection of the memory, does that ever come back, or what triggers that to come back? And if it doesn't, does a person ever, what would constitute the need to sit down and say, hey, like, it's time for some shadow work, so to speak, right?
It's controversial. There's nothing like figured out. Like, in the 90s, there was some talk show host that came out with like childhood abuse. But then it was recognized that therapists were planting ideas in people's minds that never actually happened. Something in the therapy process was starting to plant these things, because some therapists had been through horrible things, and they were so eager to help people that, without knowing it, the power of suggestion was just creating all this nonsense. So there's this woman named Elizabeth Loftus that has done really great research that is ending up getting people out of jail because of recognizing how the memory, the mind, we do not have a tape recorder or a video camera in here. It's more like computer files. And when you open your Word document and edit it and save it, it's now edited, like something changed. And that happens with memory. Every time we access it, it's a little different. And so they've done these experiments where they ask people, where were you during 9/11? And so there was the theory of the flashbulb memory, like, oh, that is so ingrained, it's like a flashbulb. And then they were just finding all these indiscrepancies, depending on when you ask them, how many times they've told the story, to the point where some big news guy, I think, somebody was humiliated because they were on a helicopter in some combat zone. And the more they told the story, the more they remembered being in the events rather than having heard about them or with the eyewitnesses. Like, it transformed. And with the research that woman did, I don't believe the guy ever meant harm. I don't think he lied. I think his memories actually went morphing to incorporate those things that he learned about. There's something called source amnesia. Ever tell a joke to someone where they tell you, yeah, duh, I'm the one that told you that joke? It's not uncommon that we forget the source of something. We have the info, but we don't remember where we heard it, where we learned it. That's very common.
So you're saying basically being cautious going into shadow work because you may or may not remember it correctly.
Absolutely.
Or you might start.
Absolutely. And not to assume that every trauma causes that much impact. There are days where I find cuts on my body where it's like, I don't even remember doing that. I'm just clumsy. Like, what is this bruise? What is that one? And you're thinking like, oh my gosh, who's in his life beating him up? It's not that kind of thing. It's like literally, sometimes I'm too distracted and then I'll be like, oh yeah, I think I kicked my bed. Like, you know how beds, sometimes the frames, your foot goes under, but you kick the frame. Like, I get some of those marks. Now, so if someone has a trauma, just because something happened doesn't mean it left a bruise, doesn't mean it made the impression that would then be needing therapy. If it didn't make an impression, it's fine.
So like, if if a person is seeking for answers, can we become so desperate looking for the answer that we sort of make ourselves believe something like, oh, it must be because of this? And yeah, we sort of like create an idea in our minds of like, oh, well, this is what happened. Now this makes sense. Now I can put it to rest because I've created this idea in my head of what might have caused this.
Like without all that consciousness, but yeah, like, yeah. To conclude that all their problems are because of the shape of their nose or something. It's the same kind of stuff. Very impressionistic. It's not rigorous fact work, cleaning up our thought patterns, questioning, zooming out, questioning. So what would it mean if? What would it mean if I was abused as a 2-year-old? Does it really mean I can't have a normal life?
Right.
Maybe the only one who needs to deal with that is the perpetrator. A topic came up earlier that I don't want to forget, which is the use of statistics for political agendas. So these are my biases, but there's a great book called Kinsey, Sex and Fraud, where a woman really looks at the life of Albert Kinsey or Alfred Kinsey, the father of the sexual revolution, where he was some kind of, I forget the fancy word for people that study insects. And so he studied insects and learned to make graphs and collect data and publish using charts and stats. And then he started looking at human sexuality and trying to overturn taboos. And he would, like a lot of his research has been proven as not that reliable because he would interview very biased samples. Like he didn't have methods to try to understand what was really going on in the broader population. But he really learned, and then Hugh Hefner was like a disciple of his that took the gospel, the good news of sex being a healthy thing, and saying, oh, well, then this should be done at all times, everywhere, with anybody. So kind of overinterpreting. Anyway, so the politicization of science, of these methods to prove an agenda. So yeah, someone was just talking about, I think it was Lily, was talking about an agenda of saying, we're going to prove somehow that if you don't have Facebook, you're weird. Like, what the heck? That doesn't sound like real science. Sounds very agendaed. Now, does that mean we can never have an agenda? I mean, you know, court of law, like, what are we trying to do? I'm trying to prove this guy murdered those people. So my job is to, I do have an agenda. Like my job is to find the evidence that shows this. Our system, one side isn't supposed to come up with both sides. One side's supposed to put all the reasons for, and the other side's supposed to put up all the reasons not to believe it.
It's like in a court of law, isn't it?
That is, yeah. So that's what I was describing.
Each person's perception.
Yeah.
And then whoever is the better at their job at that particular time wins.
But at the end of the day, all you're achieving is belief.
Right.
You're not achieving necessarily facts. You're not
achieving truth, yeah.
You're not necessarily, if there's no videotape, you're achieving, okay, there are more reasons to believe this is the killer than to set him free. And you're back to faith. So all these things about faith and science, like they're just not different processes. I mean, some faiths, yeah, are absurd and ridiculous and superstition. But the mental process, investigations that include room for macroscopic things, for things we can't see, but that we're trying to trace and trying to understand behaviors and look for footprints, these are the same processes. They shouldn't be different. There was an author in the 12th century, 13th century, who everybody got in a tizzy in the Christian world because Aristotle was discovered and becoming popular. So all these religious people were like, oh no, what are we going to do about this Greek stuff? And this guy finally, luckily, won the day by saying, we're not afraid of truth. truth will not contradict itself. The more the merrier. Like, let's figure out what's really going on in the universe. That should be everyone's pursuit, but not everybody is. Some people form their conclusions and don't want to do any more thinking and say, this is it, and this is what we're going to do. It's fine if they want to do that. They should just be honest about it. Like, nope, my data collection has stopped. I'm no longer looking for anything that contradicts my views. And that's fine too. Like, we all need to simplify and say, am I going to celebrate Christmas or not? Like, we can just make a decision too. I don't know. Life changes sometimes. And we contradict ourselves too, right? We have C.S. Lewis was an atheist for a lot of his life and then changed. People change. And it goes the other way too. Religious people flip and become atheists. Again, I would look at context. What nudged that? I still have trouble believing that Richard Hawkins wasn't influenced by being in a wheelchair all his life and relying on a mechanical voice. I suspect the guy was a little bit pissed off in life. But maybe not. Maybe his thoughts were 100% objective. I don't know. Nobody can be 100% objective, so. I don't know. And I might change my mind tomorrow. So like, if I'm offending anyone, like I actually have an unusually open mind for allowing new information and like, oh, changing my mind about stuff. All right, I didn't see any replies in the chat from the person who didn't want to ask out loud. So any final thoughts or comments? I did not take notes again. I hope I'll remember. Maybe as a group, can you guys help me? I'm just gonna, we did body dysmorphia. What else did we just talk about? Implanted memories and trauma. Childhood trauma. Perpetrator, guilt, and mental health. Barriers to help seeking in a punitive CYA system. Punitive meaning the prison system, but CYA meaning mental health provider. Like this idea that the best thing is always to get a person locked up or cover my ass that I followed the protocols. I can't use my judgment, my independent judgment as an independently licensed person. There's a lot of failure to maintain that independence. I think those were the topics. Does anyone remember anything else? Okay, well, thank you all for joining. Again, I'm going to do one more tomorrow, but then next week it's all chaotic. So I just took them all down. And then I have a travel day on the 5th, so I'm not doing it January 5th. But otherwise, I think I'll be back on the 2nd or 3rd. So one more tomorrow. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Good to see you all.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Uh-huh.